Welcome.
The voice of God.
I know.
My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, our honorary chairman, and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this program about patient-generated health information, its potential for making our health system function more efficiently and in a more consumer-friendly way. We'll be hearing about a bunch of, I guess you'd call it gee whiz technology, devices and processes that can transmit your weight or your glucose level to your electronic health record where your physician can use it to monitor your condition. And we'll hear about some of the potential advantages of that technology, challenges that those advances are encountering, and what might be done about them. We're very pleased to have two partners today in sponsoring this briefing. One is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which has been helping Americans enjoy healthier lives and get the care they need for 40 years. Somewhere in my briefcase, I have a little button that I meant to wear. And thanks very much to Brian Quinn and Steve Downs and their colleagues at RWJ for their help in thinking this program through and pulling it together. You're going to hear from Steve in a moment. The other co-sponsor is the Bipartisan Policy Center, a five-year-old project of four former Senate majority leaders, two from each party, which is the, I think, only D.C.-based think tank that actively promotes bipartisanship and which has healthcare as one of its main focus areas. And we're very pleased to have co-moderating today's discussion Janet Marchibroda, who chairs the BPC Health Information Technology Initiative. And I'd like to turn to Janet at this point. I think you got it. You got it.
Well, thank you, Ed, and it's a great pleasure to be here today and to be talking about something that is very important to us at the Health IT Initiative over at the Bipartisan Policy Center. As Ed mentioned, we were established back in 2007 by former Senate majority leaders and focused on a broad range of issues, one being health care. And we're particularly interested in the discussion today because we're talking about how one could more effectively engage consumers and patients in their health and healthcare using electronic tools, something that we focused a lot on in a recently released report of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Task Force on Delivery System Reform and Health IT. You know, we're experiencing a number of pressures in our healthcare system today between rising healthcare costs, uneven quality, eroding coverage, and clearly when you look at all of the rapidly emerging initiatives moving across the country, whether sponsored by the federal government, states, or even a number of private sector health plans and providers, all of them have a key goal of activating, engaging at a much higher level consumers and patients in their health care. And we've got a tremendous opportunity to leverage electronic tools, mobile technologies, online tools to make that happen. And in fact, in what we're going to talk about today, a number of consumers, as we've found, and there's been a great deal of research in this area, would really like to use a smartphone or a PDA to monitor their health if they were able to access their medical records and also not only download information but also push information to their clinicians and care teams. And physicians, too. Some of the research indicates there was an article that was published over the last couple of years that while 64% of physicians have never used a patient's electronic health record, 42% are willing to try, and so we're seeing a lot of interest in this area. And in fact, stage two of meaningful use, actually, there's a proposed rule that's out there right now. It actually has a number of key requirements that are proposed around further engaging patients in their health and health care using e-health tools like the ones that we're going to talk about today. So in teeing up the discussion, there are some key areas that we'll want to explore to make the exciting things that we're hearing about in this panel today move forward in a more accelerated at a more accelerated pace. The first is, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of the presentations around how between policy and market action, clinicians, this is a new thing for them, how we can continue to support and educate and help them transition to these new ways of providing care and interacting with patients. I know Devin, to my left, and Joy are going to talk about any clarification needed to policy issues and privacy, maybe a little bit about security. One of the key things that we're hearing, and I'm not sure that we'll get here today, but it is about the need to align incentives further to make sure that this happens, and then, of course, continuing to build awareness among consumers and assuring that nobody, no one, gets left behind due to access to some of these technologies and the like. And the one, and I didn't put it on the slide here for folks, there are some technical issues that would also need to be figured out. I know we've got a policy audience, but something called data provenance. What is that? Data provenance. So, and I think if you'll talk to the folks that use records as they deliver care, particularly clinicians, sort of figuring out if I've got different sets of data, where did it come from, so I have a better understanding of the source of particular data sets to help me deliver better care. But with that, Ed, those are my comments, and look forward to hearing the discussions of the panel.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Janet. Before we introduce the panel, let me just go through the logistical checklist, if I can. There will be a webcast and a podcast available sometime tomorrow on kff.org, which is the website of the Kaiser Family Foundation, to whom we are very grateful for providing that service. And in a few days, you can also view a transcript of today's discussion at our website, allhealth.org. C-SPAN is broadcasting this briefing live right now and probably in 2 a.m. reruns, so you'll be able to catch it later on this week. If you are watching us on C-SPAN right now and have access to a computer, you can go to our website, allhealth.org, and if you punch up this briefing available on our homepage, you can follow along with the PowerPoint slide presentations that the speakers will be using. There are green question cards in your packets that you can use to address a question to any or all of our panel, and a blue evaluation form, which we fervently hope you will fill out before you leave so that we can improve these briefings as we go along. So, one other announcement. This, and pardon my terminology if I don't get it right, but this briefing is being tweeted with the hashtag patientinfo. It was up on the general slide. It'll be back up there once the slide presentations are done. And you can feel free to retweet or whatever it is that one does with tweets. Now, we have a terrific panel assembled today. And as I said, I wanted to particularly thank Steve Downs and his colleagues at the Foundation for helping to do that. And only fittingly, turn first to Steve Downs. He's the Chief Technology and Information Officer at RWJ, making sure that the Foundation's technology strategy is in line with the rest of its programmatic activity. He's also the co-developer of Project Health Design, which is going to be front and center in today's conversation. Steve, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. So let's start with the key development here, which is that health is becoming digitized. Notice that I said health and not health care. I think we all understand that health care, when we think of the care that we get in hospitals, doctors' offices, pharmacies, that's all becoming digitized as well through the increasing adoption of electronic health records. But we think of health differently. Health is sort of what happens when you're not at those places. It's your day-to-day experience, and it's increasingly understood as being a function of the environment in which you live, work, learn, and play, and the decisions you make and the behaviors you take on in the context of that environment. And increasingly, we now have technology that can really open a window onto that day-to-day experience that drives your health. There are two key drivers of this, two technological drivers. And the first is the smartphone. And the way I'm going to illustrate this is through an example of a company called Ginger.io that uses data that are held on your smartphone through everyday use, the logs of your calls, your texts, the accelerometer data, which shows how you've been moving, and your GPS data, which shows where you've been. And they're able to analyze that data and actually develop what they call a behavioral signature about you. And this is really important in the case of mental health, because you may have a behavioral signature, and then they can start to look at deviations from that and say, perhaps if you're prone to depression, you might be sliding back into a depressive episode just by analyzing those data. And you have to do nothing. Now, I really want to stress for everybody out there, this is not a secret experiment they're doing on your iPhone right now. We're talking about consenting patients, controlled studies. You know, this is being done very, very carefully. But what it does is it gives you a sense of the power of the data available on your cell phone and the increasingly sophisticated things that people can do with that. The second example I'm going to use, because the second driver, is about sensors. And what I show here is a company called Green Goose, which takes tiny wireless sensors, very inexpensive sensors, and actually packages them in little stickers that you can slap on everyday household objects and then start to do things like have competitions in your family about who's doing a better job brushing your teeth. So this is just an example of the creative and very inexpensive things you can do with what are going to be increasingly ubiquitous and powerful sensors. So we're seeing this play out initially most in the fitness tracking industry. And some examples I've got up there are Fitbit, which is a really small device about the size of your thumb. You can slip it into your pocket. It will track your activity throughout the day, the calories you've burned. Put it on a wristband at night, and it will tell you how well you slept. There's the Withings Wi-Fi scale. Step on it, and you will automatically log your weight, and God forbid, you can tweet it as well that way. You can track your runs with RunKeepers. Strap your phone to your arm, go out for a jog, and it'll figure out where you went, how far that was, how fast you did it. And you can also put on a wireless heart monitor while you're doing it. And so the next time you go see your doctor and she asks you if you're getting any exercise, you can say more than, oh, yeah, you know, I'm trying. In fact, you can actually pull out charts of everywhere you've run, how far you've gone, how often you do it, how fast you've run, and for extra credit, how fast your heart beats when you run that far that fast. Now, don't try this at home. I don't recommend, actually, right now that you go to your doctor and do this. And the truth is they probably don't need to know all the gory details. But the key point here is what used to be a very vague, imprecise answer to a fairly important question about your health can now be answered with great precision. So, and it's not just limited to fitness now. You're increasingly starting to see trackers that will relate to your mood, your diet, your sleep, and many indicators and drivers of health. But the big question in all of this is, does having access to all that fine-grained data really matter? And that's the question that we've been trying to answer in Project Health Design, which is a, as Ed mentioned, a program of the National of Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Pioneer Portfolio. It's run by my colleague Patty Brennan out of the University of Wisconsin. And in that program, we funded five teams to work with real patients, real clinicians, to collect what we call observations of daily living, or ODLs. And think of ODLs as the measurements, the data associated with your day-to-day health experience. So it's data on mood, sleep, diet, exercise, stress level, pain, the meds you actually take as opposed to those that you're prescribed, and so forth. And in these studies, what we've done is the teams have created apps and services for patients to be able to capture and store these ODLs, to then actually provide feedback to the patients on the data within them. And then, and this is something we'll talk more about today, is the tricky part of then integrating that into clinical care processes, bringing that data into the doctor's office, and so on. So we have five teams working with very different populations, very different conditions, Breathe Easy, which Steve Rothmich is here to talk about, worked with low-income adult populations with asthma and typically mental health challenges like anxiety or depression as well. Chronology.md, it's a project for people with Crohn's disease in which they actually use Fitbit for activity and sleep tracking, the Wi-Fi scale for weight, and then a special app on iPads for recording things like mood, stress, energy level, and actually just a journal to record subjective thoughts about how you're feeling. And then what they would do is these data would get charted, and then they would bring them into the doctor's office and discuss them with their doctors, and you could see how their condition was developing, how the treatments were progressing. DwellSense is a project that worked with seniors who were at risk of cognitive decline. And what this is, it illustrates the power of sensors. They looked at three sort of general daily routine tasks, making phone calls, taking medications, and making coffee. And they put sensors on them, and then they looked for patterns that might show that people are starting to have a little bit more confusion about completing those tasks. They're making more mistakes, or they're taking longer to do them, to see if you could actually start to notice the onset or progression of cognitive decline. Estreita is a project that worked with infants who were born prematurely, who had just spent time in a neonatal intensive care unit, to come home and actually have their parents then track progress about the babies, things like number of diaper changes, weight. Also look at things like, are the parents doing bonding activities with those children? But then also look at the parents' general sort of well-being. You know, what's their mood day to day? Anyone who has experienced parenthood for the very first weeks or so know that it's a pretty intense time, and you've got to watch your own health during that. And then the last one is InTouch, which worked with young women, teens and young adults who are obese and also suffering from depression. And they had a mobile app where they could record information about their diet, their activity, a little bit of their social activity, and also their mood as well. And then they would review those data with health coaches who would give them feedback on how they're doing. So I want to emphasize a couple of things about these projects. And first of all is that we're talking about patients with serious health challenges. These are all tough diseases, and as you see in a number of examples, they have coincident conditions as well. So it's not just asthma, it's asthma and depression, for example. These are patients that are very high cost to the system because of the complications of their conditions. These are also not typically sort of affluent, tech-savvy patients. A lot of these folks are from low-income backgrounds and had very little familiarity with the technology that they were using in the project. I also want to emphasize these projects are just wrapping up and the evaluations have not been completed. So, you know, we don't have very hard, clear findings of that. But I can share some preliminary observations that we've seen in the experiences of those projects. First is sort of the question of, would people actually do this? Would people track their mood or track their diet using mobile devices or other ways? And the answer is, by and large, yes. Certainly not everybody, and not everybody who did would track it all the time. But we saw a substantial number of people who really did put in enough effort of the tracking that we could gain some value from it. There are definitely examples of where the direct feedback to patients made a difference. So, for example, in the DwellSense project, showing somebody their day-to-day medication adherence, you know, when they've been taking their pills, if they've been taking their pills, actually brought some real insight to patients who said, geez, I thought I was doing really well, but now I look at this and I'm not. You know, I need to start to adjust my routines a bit and do well. There are cases in the InTouch project where people who are tracking their diet regularly actually started to make real changes in those diets and other habit changes as well, and started to actually in some cases lost quite a lot of weight. And there's definite examples of information making a difference in treatment. Now, Steve's going to talk about a couple of examples from the Breathe Easy project, but there's one from the Chronology MD project that I wanted to share because I thought it provided a great example. And this is a quote from a patient and who actually first writes, you know, is there any way to extend the study? And says, quote, I'm finding this very useful. I've used this data with other doctors outside of the study, and as a result of sharing this data with other docs, I've changed the meds that I was on. As a result of this med change, my quality of life has gone way up. My weight has gone from 112 to 119 pounds, and I should say that's a good thing in this case. And I am not vomiting daily. So this is a really good example of how a little bit of information, this day-to-day information, can make it not only make a difference in treatment, but that the change in treatment can actually make a difference in the person's health. So this also represents a real challenge to the system. I think we all know that doctors are extremely busy, and the current mode of practice does not make it easy to add in the extra time to be able to review these data. The second thing, as we talk about electronic health records, is they're generally not very well positioned to accept a lot of patient-generated data, and particularly the kind of ODLs that we're talking about. It's one thing to figure out how to engineer in patient-recorded readings of blood pressure. It's another to figure out how to record patient-generated readings of mood, of which there are very few standards right now. So to summarize, I want to say that technology is creating sort of a new opportunity to practice medicine somewhat differently. The small studies that we've done, the early studies that we've done, are showing there's real promise in there, and not just with sort of typically tech-savvy, affluent patients. And as often the case with technology-led innovations, the policy environment, the policy context around which they play out, was not developed with these kind of innovations in mind. And so we're going to have to take a look at that. And I know that Joy's going to address some of that. Devin will address that. And that's really the conversation that I hope we all have today. So thank you very much.
Good. Thank you very much, Steve. And indeed, speaking of practicing medicine, we now turn to Dr. Stephen Rothamich, who's an associate professor of family medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. And he's the co-director of the Breathe Easy project that Steve Downs was talking about, which is run with the help of the folks at VCU using advanced technology for caring for patients with asthma. Dr. Rothamich also co-directs VCU's practice-based research network. And, Steve, we're very happy to have you with us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm the lead clinical investigator on this project, but I want to be sure to acknowledge Dr. Masoudi, who you see over on the right side of the slide. She is the lead investigator of the entire project, and she works at RTI and is a leading researcher in user-centered design, which was a very important part of developing this app. I also want to reinforce what Steve Downs said about the variety of the different five projects in Project Health Design. I encourage you to go look at those because, frankly, we have more clinical integration than some of the projects, but a lot less with the physical sensors and the electronic passive acquisition of data. Most of ours, our data collection, did require a patient step to those. But with that, let me go on to the next slide here. There we go. Ah, good. All right, so I'm going to talk first about the app and then go back to the patients and what we saw. So the patients in our project entered their ODL data through the Breathe Easy app on an Android smartphone. So I've got a variety of screenshots there for you. If you look at the one on the left at the top, enter your daily data. This is the place where the subject with asthma would go on a daily basis to answer a series of questions for the ODLs that we negotiated between patients and clinicians as being the ones that we would track for this study. Those included the use of controller medications if they were on one, use of rescue medications and why they had to use it, their peak flow readings, which is a measure of how well they're able to move air, the exposure to asthma triggers, mood, anxiety, sleep, exercise, tobacco use if they smoked, and whether asthma limited their activities and what symptoms they had. So you'll see that in terms of the user's experience, there were check boxes, radio buttons, places to type in numbers, and this is the basic process that they would do. The next couple of icons on that left screen, enter rescue meds, enter peak flow data, those were optional ones that the subjects could use during the day if they wanted to report additional ODLs about those things. Otherwise, they could wait till the next day and enter those. Another important one is that last one over there where it says dashboard. So I'm going to talk about the clinician dashboard in just a minute, but this same data was viewable by the patient for the information that they had entered in their ODLs. Okay, this is a screenshot of a clinician dashboard. This is what the clinicians used in the practices. It was web-based. They used this on the laptops or desktops that they used to access their electronic medical record in their practice. And I want to just point out a couple of things to you because I know it's a little hard to read because it's not full screen size. But at the top of the screen, you'll notice a green, yellow, and red bars across there. Those are where we displayed the peak flow readings. And we used the National Asthma Guidelines numbers of 80% or better of your predicted peak flow being green, so that's good where it should be. And if it's less than 50% of what it should be, that's red. That's the danger zone that definitely requires some action, and obviously yellow is in the middle for that. Below that, you'll see a lot of green and red dots. Let me explain what those are. What we did is the other ODLs that we decided to display on the dashboard, which going down that list are controller meds, rescue meds, asthma triggers, anxiety, mood, sleep, smoking, and asthma symptoms. We kind of tried to make this as easy as we could for the clinicians and say green was good, red's bad. So green is a desired state. For example, if you're on a controller medicine, you did use it. You were not exposed to asthma triggers today. You did not have symptoms. And red was things like you had to use your rescue inhaler today. You had asthma symptoms or you smoked. So that's what the clinicians looked at. Now I'm going to get back to talking about the setting and the patients. I wanted to be sure to mention that before we did the 6 months of evaluation, there was a whole series of steps with user-centered design process in terms of having focus groups of patients and clinicians and look at mock-ups, improve what we had done, go back to them, and see if did we get it right before we actually fielded it. So with the patients, we actually studied this in 30 patients with moderate to severe asthma. And the reason for we picked that is that patients with mild asthma might actually not benefit from the app. There's not much going on with them that we would actually see. We also did this study in two inner-city practices, so that influences the patients we worked with, predominantly black women. 24 of the 30 had low income, 18 of the 30 had low educational attainment as well. And why that group? Well, this is the group that it's more challenging to do this kind of work in. So if we can get folks who would have a harder time doing this to do it successfully, then probably anyone can. So they entered their ODL data at a time of day of their choice. They got a text message to remind them if they forgot. And each of them was given a smartphone with 6 months of phone and data service during this evaluation period. I think two of the subjects had a smartphone already, and not all of them, I don't think, had cell phones. So those are the patients we work with. The practices I mentioned, two inner city practices in Richmond, same health system, same electronic medical record. I work in one of those. 13 family physicians, 7 nurses, and we did this study in nurse-doc teams, which is typically how we practice. So once a week, what the nurses would do is they had a protocol that they would look at the dashboard data that I just showed you a minute ago and determine whether there was actionable information there that needed to be escalated to the physician to address. And we focused principally on peak flow, whether or not they were using their controller medicine, whether they had to use their rescue medicine, and whether they were having symptoms. Because we, as clinicians, knew what to do with that. Some of the other ones we looked at, like sleep, but we weren't as clear what should we do with those things. And the practices were paid $500 per subject to monitor that patient for 6 months, and we modeled that in a way that reimbursed them for their time for doing that work. The way an insurance company would probably call that disease management, or we probably now talk about medical home payments, perhaps. Okay, so this first example, I have two I'm going to show you. The first one here is an exciting one. This is a young, relatively healthy person whose biggest health problem besides their asthma is that they smoke. And this patient, I've actually collapsed to show you 6 months of ODL data so you can see the pattern in the peak flows. It makes it very hard to read those nice red and green dots at the bottom, but I'm mainly showing you the peak flow here. So you'll notice that this subject at the beginning of the study was red, yellow most of the time. There, the nurse messaged the physician about that there was a continued pattern of this, and right about right before it starts to go up into the yellow, the clinician they'd not been successful getting the patient to come in for an office visit, decided, hey, I'm going to just go ahead and start this person on a controller medicine because obviously they need one. And that was called in. The nurse talked to the patient about how to use it. They started using it. And about a week later, up go the peak flows, up into the yellow to green zone, pretty much staying there the rest of the time. And not just these numbers, but also if you look at the second row of rescue meds and the last row of asthma symptoms at the bottom, you'll see that there's less rescue med use and fewer days with asthma symptoms in the second 3 months of this study after they got on the controller medicine. Those of you who are looking at the controller med row and noticing that it's red all the way across, the way we set this up, if you weren't on a controller medicine at the beginning, you actually didn't get asked that question. So that row is not relevant for this subject. But that was exciting. That green dot that's way up there is probably a spurious reading, either a typo or somebody collected their peak flow with a cough, which can make it look much higher than it is. I think a typo. Okay, this is the second one I want to talk about. This is a much more challenging patient. This is a subject in their early 50s, comorbid hypertension, depression, chronic pain. All three of those are very common in this population. And something that, thank goodness, most of them don't have, lupus as well. This is showing about 2 months' worth of data, so you can actually see these stars and X's a little bit better. But when we started collecting data on this patient, all of these numbers were actually in the red zone. And the reason that they look better than that now is the primary care physician caring for this patient and I made a decision that obviously our predicted peak flow, which is a formula-based one, was not accurate for this subject, and we used the actual best readings that they had done to kind of reset the peak flows, which moved them up into the green. But these are, if you look at those, 300 is not a really good number. So what happened with this subject is the nurse observed the lower peak flows, the patterns of meds. They're using their controller medicine right, yet they've got to use the rescue medicine every day. They're having asthma symptoms just about every day. And the clinician in this case decided to order a pulmonary function test, which is a much fancier test than the peak flow that the patient's did. And what they found was that this was not reversible, and asthma is supposed to be a reversible lung disease. You give the albuterol rescue medicine, you see better numbers, and this patient didn't. So the diagnosis of a different lung condition, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, was entertained by this clinician, even though this patient does not smoke. They were referred to a pulmonology specialist. The pulmonologist did more tests, decided that indeed this was asthma, just severe refractory asthma, and that this was a candidate for monthly immunotherapy drugs that we don't administer in my practice. It's only a specialty-based care type situation. And this patient had actually not started those at the very beginning. So if we'll go to the last slide very quickly since I'm running over time. We did separate patient and clinician forums at the end of the study, and these are just a few things I want to mention that we've learned at this point. Patients found it easy to use. They reported they enjoyed collecting and viewing the ODLs. They understood their asthma and their triggers better. So we're very encouraged by that. They could actually do this. Frankly, it surprised me how well they could actually do this. The clinicians were not overwhelmed, and that was good news because we were a little bit worried about how that would go. And they reported that it indeed provided clinically useful information. There were education opportunities. There were a couple of patients who had their controller meds and their rescue meds, the pattern of using that exactly opposite. They misunderstood how to use them, and that was corrected by the nurses over the phone. We had patients who had their therapy escalated, sometimes between or without visits or at visits, And we had, as I mentioned, diagnosis changed. We had three subjects who were diagnosed with COPD, and one changed back to the severe refractory asthma. I'm done.
Very good. Thank you very much, Steve.
You're welcome.
We can pass that flicker back and forth. You've heard a couple of very interesting presentations about how some of these technologies work in the real world. And now we're going to turn to a couple of folks who know an awful lot about the policy implications of starting to use these technologies. And we're going to start with Devin McGraw, who's the director of the Health Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology, where she works on ensuring individual privacy as electronic health information is shared electronically. She's also on the Health Information Technology Policy Committee that was set up by the 2009 stimulus law. So we're very pleased to have Devin McGraw with us this afternoon.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ed. So I do a lot of work on policy issues around privacy and security, but with respect to Project Health Design, I took on what was really a bit of a new role for me. I teamed up with a law firm, Manat Phelps and Phillips, to be part of a legal and regulatory assurance team for the Project Health Design grantees to both assist them in kind of navigating the laws that would apply to the projects as they were doing them and providing them with a path forward for where they wanted to go, but also to try to surface some of the bigger policy implications that really arose out of the projects collectively as well as individually. And that, you know, it's really exciting to have an opportunity to think about these issues in a kind of on-the-ground implementation way and see really where the rubber meets the road. So we started with the grantees by providing them with legal memos, and thankfully my colleagues at Manat, Phelps and Phillips handled this aspect of it. You know, just down nitty-gritty, you know, you've got five grantees in three different states, and all of them subject to the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act rules around privacy and security. Most of you know that as HIPAA. And so how does HIPAA apply to these projects? How does state law apply to these projects in terms of being able to move them forward? But in addition to the concerns about basic compliance with the law, each of the grantees very early on in the projects identified sort of three buckets of concerns that they had from a policy standpoint, one being security for the mobile tools that the patients were going to be using in each of these projects. You know, we won't go too down in the weeds about security and mobile devices, but I think many of you may know that mobile devices often are not as secure as other forms of computer communication. Sometimes you can buy and purchase features that will make your mobile tools more secure, but most people don't tend to use them, and it's often difficult to figure out how to do that. There were also some concerns raised about potential professional or malpractice liability by the clinicians for, you know, the potential to be receiving all of this data from their patients. What if they didn't see something that was in the data, and what if they missed it, and what would that mean for them from a professional liability standpoint? And then, as I'll explain in a minute, you know, HIPAA as a privacy and security policy regime doesn't apply to all health data in all contexts. It covers some data some of the time, but not all health data all of the time. And so given that some of the data was going to be collected and stored in environments that were not going to be covered by HIPAA, what did that mean for the patients? And these were all really concerns that were primarily surfaced by the project sponsors, but really on behalf of the people that they were going to be asking to participate in these projects. I think an overarching theme that it's important to stress from the very beginning is that these arrangements are very unique and innovative, but they can be done. And these legal and policy concerns that were surfaced from the very beginning, there were plans for managing them, and certainly from a legal standpoint, all could be done in compliance with the law. So as I mentioned earlier, you know, really HIPAA applies to the data in these projects when it's handled by the healthcare providers. So when, for example, the data came into to Steve's dashboard and the clinicians looked at it, that data would be covered by the HIPAA privacy and security rules. But when the patients who were participating in the projects were entering that data into their mobile devices, that data actually was not covered by HIPAA. And so you know, you had a regime where you had a certain set of rules that would apply to sort of part of the projects, like maybe half of the projects or 40% of the projects, but the other part of the project would not necessarily be covered by clear or, depending on how you feel about them, less than clear rules. But no, you know, rules that are basically, you know, if you pick up and start using a mobile device and entering data in a mobile app, you need to read the privacy policy to determine sort of what the data sharing rules are that are going to apply to that data. And those promises can be enforced by the Federal Trade Commission, but that's not the same as necessarily having a comprehensive set of rules about how that data can and cannot be used. There may be state laws that apply, and again, we had grantees, three of them in California and two of them in two other states. Sometimes the state laws, the application of those laws is different in terms of who they apply to. But even at the state level, there isn't typically a regime where all health data, no matter who holds it, is subject to some sort of protections. But each grantee was only responsible for complying with its own state law. We did have a project that involved minors, the InTouch project, and the adolescents and teens struggling with weight issues and sometimes mental health issues. And there, state law often provides a very big role in determining sort of who can access a data and placing some protections around that data. In the case of that particular project, which took place in California, there are actually strong rights for minors to be able to direct and control their own data when it's in the healthcare system. Of course, those rules are not as applicable outside the healthcare system. One thing that was incredibly helpful in each of these projects is that all of the institutions involved treated this as a research project, which meant that it was subject to internal review, and all the participants were consented into the projects, and so they really sort of understood what was going on, how their data was going to be used and collected, an environment that isn't always present in the private sector when you talk about consumers using off-the-shelf products. It really created moments of transparency and education for the patients that we don't always have when we're talking about the purchase and use of tools in a commercial space. So as these projects are wrapping up, we're trying to take the experience of the Project Health Design grantees in managing these sort of critical policy issues and turn them into papers that can help inform others who might seek to engage in similar projects. And the first paper that we did was really about mobile device security, and it's actually been published in the Journal of Health Information Management in the summer issue, and there's a copy of it in your packets, and it's also available online. Here, again, remember that the mobile tools are being used by the patients. And so many of the sort of security devices and policy recommendations that you might mandate be used in a provider context, when you're talking about patients using these tools and making sure that they're able to utilize them in a comfortable way and enter the data, you might have a different equation. Like, for example, if you say to a patient, well, you have an ability to password protect your device, but you can't make patients password protect their devices, right? So the extent to which they use those password protections was really up to them. Another example was where the grantee really took the discretion out of the patient's hand but put in the capability of being able to remotely wipe the device of data if it were lost or stolen. So that's something that's not the patient doesn't feel or is not impactful to them, but gives them a level of comfort that the device was lost or stolen. And not surprisingly, in fact, it did happen in at least one of the projects that there was a device that was lost, and they were able to remotely wipe the data off of the device so that it couldn't be accessed by persons who are not authorized to see it. So the paper includes a number of best practices. Again, we looked to the HIPAA security rule for some guidance, but it was really a realm where the security rule didn't necessarily apply, and it provides a set of best practices. A second paper that we have in draft and that we're seeking to have published is how did the professional liability concerns get managed? And essentially there are sort of two overarching themes to this paper. One is that this sort of idea of a never-ending potential stream of data from the patients that the provider wouldn't be able to manage did not happen in any of these projects. They were very carefully thought through. As Dr. Rothmanch mentioned, there was a negotiation between the providers and the patients about what data would be collected, who was going to look at it, how often. Not in any project did the data, like, automatically just get dumped into the electronic health record without decisions being made about what data, when, how. Very, very careful planning on that on their part, and so as a result, there really was a level of comfort by the clinicians participating in all the projects, as well as the patients about, you know, in terms of the expectations were very clear, and people stuck to them, and that was we perceive that to be very important. There's not a lot of case law on this, as you can imagine. These are very new types of arrangements, but in terms of sort of looking at ways to manage concerns by providers, it is absolutely doable, but you have to be willing to put the time in to having those discussions and having those understandings be very clear among both the providers and the patients. And then the last paper that we're really looking at is the issue of deals with the issue of we do have privacy protections for one part of this equation, and we don't have them necessarily for the other part of the equation. And what does that mean in an environment where we really are trying to encourage patients to use these tools in a more robust way, particularly where they are outside of a research project where you have those kind of built-in opportunities to talk to people about, you know, what this means for them, what the potential risks are, what the potential benefits, and then they can make decisions accordingly. What does that mean for policy going forward? And that's a paper that we're actually trying to write, not as we speak right now, but we're working on that. So I think that's all I had to say about that, but I'm certainly going to be here to answer questions about how we dealt with those issues in these particular projects. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Devin. Let me pass that down and turn, excuse me, finally, to Joy Pritz, who is the original Chief Privacy Officer in the office of the HHS Office of National Coordinator for HIT, otherwise known as the ONC. She's been at that post for 2.5 years, and we've asked her today to tell us a bit not only about privacy concerns, but also about her office's interest in patient-generated data more generally. And Joy, thank you so much for being with us, particularly on the short notice that you got to be part of the event.
Thank you for having us. My office, before I start, I wanted to explain a little bit for you who are not familiar with our office. It is the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. The office was formally created in a high-tech bill, and which is part of the Economic Recovery Act. And our office is designed to incentivize people to adopt health information technology and health information exchange. So it is a somewhat, it is a unique office in the department because it really is totally focused on health information technology and exchange. But HHS as a whole has a real interest in putting the patient at the center. Anybody who has read the Affordable Care Act knows that HHS and the Congress, when they drafted the Affordable Care Act, put the patient in the center. We are going to follow the patient, not just have isolated instances of care. And as that, it's essential that the patient be a partner in their care. They are the one who has a lot of the information, as everybody has said, about what their everyday life is like and how that impacts their care. Most care, as you all know, doesn't take place within the clinical setting. It actually takes place outside of the clinic. And so it's really important that we know what's happening outside of that environment. People who are engaged in their own care demonstrate better health outcomes, and I think all of these projects that are being run by Project Health Design demonstrate that it's a challenge sometimes to get people engaged in their own health care. People have a lot of other things on their plate to do. And they also face a lot of, I would say, cultural challenges in becoming more involved in their health care, because this is one of those areas where the culture is changing even as we speak. But when people are engaged, they do have can have better health outcomes. And as Janet was mentioning earlier, patients now, they expect to be engaged through IT in everything that they do, including in their health. The fact that health has been so far behind the ball in this area is somewhat surprising, because it is one of those things that is really core to people's lives, every bit as essential as any financial management. So HHS has a number of patient-centered initiatives. One which many of you have probably heard of is Text for Health, which involved a lot of different smaller programs where primarily they were focused on providers generating text messages to patients. Text for Babies was one in which providers generated reminder notices of appointments and things of that to women who were expecting children. This program has greatly expanded, and there are a number of projects available. We have a list of resources at the end of my slide, so if you're interested in seeing some more of these projects, you can read about them on that website. And some of the more recent projects are going to be much more interactive. HHS also, as a whole, has shown that's interest in giving patients access to more of their own health information by releasing a notice of proposed rulemaking almost a little bit over a year ago now, with the CLIA and the HIPAA privacy rule. And for those of you who are not familiar with this little piece of HIPAA lore, when individuals were given access to their health information under HIPAA, there is a little carve-out for information which was held by clinical laboratories who are subject to the Clinical Laboratories Improvement Act. To make a long story short, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, which is a joint rule because there were pieces of HIPAA as well as pieces of CLIA that had to be changed in order to make this happen, it would expand the rights of patients to directly access their lab test results. And it's designed to empower patients to be more informed partners with their healthcare providers. And as Janet mentioned earlier in more detail than I will go into, there are also provisions in the NPRM for Meaningful Use Stage 2 that also focus on making information more accessible to patients. ONC in particular has really taken a focus on this area and has in fact created an Office of Consumer Engagement, which is currently being run by the acting director, Ligia Riccardi, who many of you are familiar with. And this really, I think, demonstrates how committed ONC is to not only making sure that providers are meaningfully using health information, but also that patients can also do the same thing. The consumer engagement strategy is based on what we fondly refer to as the three A's: access, action, and attitude. And it is very much kind of oriented towards meaningful use for patients, that they should have access to their own health information, that they should be able to easily take action with that information in a meaningful way, and that some of these attitudes that have been ingrained in some areas of healthcare for a while, that patients are something that healthcare happens to instead of that patients engage in, need to change. And we are working on all three of these three A's in many projects. In particular, ONC has a number of patient-generated data initiatives, And one of these is a paper, a white paper, which was commissioned from RTI, and it was released in April of this year. And it discusses the technical, operational, legal, cultural, and education issues that surround patient-generated data, because as Devin was mentioned earlier, this is an area that is a little bit different than the way we have thought about health information in the past, as being something that's just generated in a clinical context and flows just one way. The policy committee, which was created under HITECH, also had a hearing on patient-generated data in June of this year, very recently. And this hearing material is also available on our website for those of you who have more interest in it. There's also a study on patient access to their health information, which looks at patient getting their access to their information, reviewing it, and giving feedback to their providers. And it's exploring how the patients and the providers are able to engage with this, and whether some of the challenges which people thought would occur with patient-generated data have occurred in the system, similar to some of the questions that were raised in some of the project health design projects. This project is being conducted by NORC at the Geisinger, and the anticipated date of release of this study is the first quarter of 2013. And as Devin has raised earlier, these patient-generated data does raise a number of legal issues, and in particular, privacy and security issues. As you all know, we in this country regulate in a very sector-specific way. So we have some rules that apply to this little piece here and other rules that apply to this piece here. And a lot of people, particularly consumers, do think that HIPAA protects all of their health information, and that is not the case. As Devin mentioned, it does not apply when individuals are entering their own information into a system such as the ones that have been described. We recognize this. As a matter of fact, the administration has recognized that there are a number of ways in which people interact on the Internet where the privacy protections probably do need to be heightened. And so there is a White House initiative on Internet privacy, and it would actually provide what I like to refer to as kind of a safety net protection that would cover some information that's exchanged on the Internet when it is not covered by HIPAA or other federal laws. In addition to these large kind of policy issues, we have done a lot of work on mHealth and privacy and security in my office, in particular in the Office of the Chief Privacy Officer. One of the things that we looked at was the security in mobile devices. That was mainly done from a provider perspective, but we looked at it from the devices as they came out of the box. And it is very interesting to look at. There's just a sea of red, even some devices where you could not set a password if you wanted to. In addition to that, we are conducting a focus group research. This came out of the Text for Health recommendations that we look into this issue in particular about consumer attitudes to privacy and security on their mobile devices and what were the trade-offs that they were willing to make and some potential safeguards. In addition to this, we're also working with the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, which is another acronym called NSTIC, which addresses the issue, one of the issues that Janet raised when she did her opening about identity proofing patients and authenticating them when they are working, submitting information on the Internet. And those are some of the main things that we're focusing on. And we do have this list of websites that you can go to for more information on the work that we're doing in this area.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Joy. We are now at the opening up of the conversation stage in this program. There are microphones that you can use to go to and verbalize your question. And as I mentioned, there are green cards in your packets that you can write your question on. If you will hold that card up, somebody on our staff will pluck it from your fingers and bring it forward. And to get us started, Janet, you've been scribbling questions as the presentations have gone ahead. Why don't you get us started?
Thank you, Ed. I'd like to direct my first question to Dr. Rothmich. Well, first of all, thank you for sharing your experiences on the ground with us, and it was terrific to hear about all of the positive outcomes that you experienced as a result of using these technologies. So let's just say, if we were to look at scaling this, you know, across the country, you know, improving these types of interactions among clinicians and patients, which is very exciting, what actions, either policy or otherwise, do you believe need to be taken to assist particularly your fellow clinicians moving forward?
Well, this audience is probably a more policy expert than I am, but one of the things that I think we saw was that even with 30 patients in two practices, this was a sizable amount of work, additional work, new work that they were taking on to do this. And so I think one of the policy implications would be that, you know, with any work that gets done at the end of the day, someone's got to pay for that time to get it done. So whatever the mechanism of payment might be, perhaps it's something that's directly reimbursable. Perhaps it's something that is a potential savings to the organization if it's an accountable care organization or something like that. So I don't know what the exact solution is there, but I do want to acknowledge that it's a fair amount of work. From the practice's perspective, I think that we would not have wanted or found it useful to do this with every patient in our practice who had asthma. So we're focusing in on the ones that there was more likelihood of benefit. And we did see that for 6 months, the clinicians and the patients both felt this was doable and useful. But I don't know that either would necessarily say that after 2 years. So one of the things that I think we'd want to think about is there are probably certain times where certain patients would benefit from looking at this information this intensely. The patients who are having repeated visits to the ER, we can't get their asthma controlled, and for a time that would need to be looked at very closely. And then obviously the practices have to figure out how to do this workflow that is working.
Thank you.
We have a number of people lined up at the microphones. I would ask you to, A, identify yourselves, and, B, keep your questions as brief as you possibly can so we can get through everybody's inquiries. And I don't know who was first. We'll start on my right, your left.
Sure. Great stuff. This is Nathan. I'm Nathan Dansky from the HIV Medicine Association. My question is about utilization. So if you could talk about, I guess, two parts of utilization. One is in terms of increasing patients' ability to understand their own health care. If there is any resistance from insurers who may not want to detail, you know, what might be covered, what might be free. So, you know, some people's business model is based on people not utilizing health care as much as they could be. So if there's any barriers or resistance, or if there needs to be change there, you know, maybe your insurance provider doesn't want you to know that you can get a free pair of glasses or you get this free, whatever it is. On the other side, is there opportunities, and do you think this will affect perhaps the copay structure? For example, if you get, you know, alerts saying, hey, get your free HIV test. It's that time of year. Get a free flu shot. Get this free preventative visit. So what do you see happening as far as utilization goes, and what barriers lie ahead?
Steve, everybody seems to be turning to you.
Great questions. I think the utilization is really probably going to depend very much on the cases of who's using it under what circumstances, I think, as Steve detailed. I mean, in some ways, I think what Steve was sort of arguing is you need to find the case, sort of almost the business cases around under what circumstances does it make sense to do sort of an intensive look at someone's information. because you think that's going to make them healthier and in the long run maybe you reduce utilization. And that does point to models like accountable care organizations where actually that, realizing those savings makes a difference and is part of the business model. You know, and to be honest, we haven't engaged deeply with the insurance industry on this, you know, other than to have an advisor from that industry. And these projects were sort of kind of done off books in that sense. The copay thing is really interesting because this sort of model of practicing care gets you a little bit away from the notion that healthcare is delivered in doses where you show up to an office and receive a treatment. This is sort of saying it's much more kind of a continuous relationship, and the idea of a copay, you know, starts to make less sense. Or maybe the copay is, yeah, if you really want to come in and you know, come into the office and use the office and talk to somebody, that's a copay. But if you want to in this direction, maybe there's no copay at all. So I don't know if others have thoughts on that.
Anybody else? No, go ahead.
Yes, hi. My name is Al Guida with Guide Consulting Services, and I represent NetSmart Technologies, which is a vendor that provides electronic health records to mental health and addiction providers. And this is a question to Joy Pritz. We have become concerned about reports, confirmed reports, that state health information exchanges are not accepting mental health and addiction electronic health records because of conflicting interpretations of state and federal patient confidentiality consent laws, particularly related to mental health and addiction records. And we know, Joy, that you're working with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration on these issues. So I've got two questions very quickly. Number one, if you could just tell the audience a bit about how ONC works with SAMHSA on the special confidentiality issues related to mental health and addiction records. And then secondly, anything you could say about this pressing HIE matter would be, I think, very helpful to us. I'll take your response seated.
In response to your first question, we work very closely with SAMHSA on the confidentiality rules. For those of you who are not familiar with those rules, there is a set of federal regulations that apply directly to substance abuse and mental health, substance and alcohol abuse treatment facilities that receive federal support, which is very broadly defined. Those rules are more stringent than the HIPAA privacy rule. And they require an individual's express permission to share their information, even for treatment purposes. The purpose behind that rule, when it was originated, was to make sure that people who had these conditions would come in and get treatment without fear of being arrested, frankly. To our knowledge, that last piece has not changed over the years, that there is still danger. Potential risk of this information falling into the wrong hands. So the challenge that has evolved is that the rules were written very much at a time in a paper world. And so although the policy may not have changed, the implementation of that policy into an electronic environment has proven to be somewhat challenging. We work very closely with SAMHSA. We are working with them on the trying to find some solutions to this. We have heard, as you have stated, anecdotally, that some of the health information exchange organizations that are forming are hesitant to accept information that is generated from these substance abuse and mental health facilities because it's one of those areas where the protection actually follows the data. So if it's generated in what we shorthand call a 42 CFR Part 2 facility, then when it's exchanged with goes into the patient consent for it to be shared and the recipient gets it, they may not redisclose that information unless they have the patient's express permission. So we're working on a number of different fronts on how to tackle this issue because we recognize, and the administration recognizes, how important it is to have these substance abuse and mental health really integrated into primary care. One of the things that my office has been doing for the last year is working on standards development for metadata tagging this information that might help provide a technological solution to this challenge. And as you know, because you mentioned it, that the SAMHSA has been working with a number of states and to try to find ways that they can not necessarily harmonize, go back and redraft all kinds of laws and things, but look at the interpretation of things that exist in their states to see if at least they can come up with some common solutions of approaches to some of these issues. One of the keys here for the people need to understand is that the preemption, the federal preemption, the way HIPAA treats federal preemption is that state law which is equal to or more stringent than the privacy protections in HIPAA remain in place. So that in itself, it's not just those two areas that you mentioned. In any state law where state law mandates that an individual's consent be obtained for these specific purposes, it's presenting a challenge. And I think it's very important to point out that it's not just this one little area. It's a much wider issue.
Joy, while we have you thinking about the reach of HIPAA, there's a question on a card that I think we can dispose of fairly quickly. And the questioner would like to know whether the health and history information they enter into a terminal in their doctor's office is covered by HIPAA.
Provided that your health care provider is covered by HIPAA, yes, it should be.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, we're back here. John.
Hi. John Green with the National Association of Health Underwriters. So I wanted to know if the panel shared a concern that I have relative to apps and a provision in PDUFA that would give oversight of approving apps through the FDA, and that whole process, which is can be very timely and costly, where the shelf life of an app is short, and a lot of these people who develop them are working out of their garage, for instance, and coming up with apps. You've got to make it worthwhile for them. So I wonder if you had any concerns, anyone, relative to this oversight of apps. You know, is a smartphone now a medical device that has to be approved by the FDA? I mean, we'd still be waiting for Angry Birds if it had to go through FDA.
If whoever answers that, would you take a moment to explain to some of us what PDUFA is? Is it a town in Illinois?
I think that's Paducah. Prescription drug user fee amendments.
PDUFA was getting a law that was reauthorized this year. And, you know, this whole issue of apps was included. Because FDA now says, well, they'd like to have a peek at apps and whether or not it's a medical device and, you know, the tax aside, how long it takes to get things approved when they don't have the staff and management now to do the work that they already have now want to take this on.
So I don't, Joy, did you want to take that one? Because I'm happy to talk about it, but
I'd prefer not to.
Okay. Since she doesn't work for the FDA. Yes, it is the case that the Food and Drug Administration is looking at the extent to which it's congressionally authorized authority to regulate something that is a medical device would extend to certain things that are on your phone, like an app. I doubt it's going to extend to Angry Birds. Those of us who don't play it might think maybe it should.
There aren't any studies that show that it improves health or decreases health.
No. But so I think it's a difficult
line to draw? Because on the one hand, if there are two guys in a garage creating an app that a healthcare provider is going to use to make a decision about me clinically, where it actually operates a lot like a medical device in terms of saying, here's what that person's blood pressure is at this moment, here's what it is after they do a certain thing, and somebody makes a medical or a clinically relevant decision based on that, I want somebody to look at it and make sure that it actually works as it's being presented to the world and being sold to the world. On the other hand, if you've got a device that's basically helping you track your fitness level, where you may be using it in terms of deciding whether you're going to run faster the next day, and maybe if it's off by a tenth of a mile or two, nobody's going to die, that doesn't necessarily need to get, you know, through full device regulation procedure. I think that what the FDA is trying to do is draw a line, and they're attempting to do this. What's a mobile medical app, for example, and what's a wellness app, and what are sort of the types of information that are more on the sort of clinical medical side generated and collected by an app and used to make a clinical decision versus information that's used to help your wellness? That is not an easy line to draw. As Steve Downs made the point, you know, information that doesn't look like healthcare information in one context is in fact relevant to your health in other contexts, and how do you draw that line? So from somebody who represents consumers in some of these discussions, I don't know that I want to say FDA go away to some of these apps that in fact are designed to be used to make medically relevant decisions, where if the device, you know, maybe there's a test that, you know, would a piece of false information coming out of this device result in somebody getting hurt, then I do want somebody looking at, you know, some sort of standards that are applied. Having said that, you know, what does that look like? Under what conditions? I don't think is at all clear, and to the extent that, you know, regulation when it's not done appropriately and surgically correctly can be an innovation killer, that's a problem too. But I don't think it's as easy as saying apps shouldn't be regulated at all, yeah, because some of them actually are used for clinical decision making.
I agree with Devin. And if you go back to the example I did earlier of the company that looks at the data on your cell phone and establishes a behavioral signature and then is able to look for changes against that signature. If the output of that was to say, we've noticed a change in your behavior, it appears that you may be sliding back into depression, you should double your dose of Prozac immediately in order to stave that off. That, yeah, you kind of would want that regulated. If what they're doing is to saying, we've noticed a change in your behavior, where, you know, there, you may be concerned about this, you might want to discuss this with your doctor to discuss, you know, to figure out appropriate course of action. I mean, and so those are sort of easy lines to draw, I think. But what you hear in the developer community is the most important thing is that however they're drawn, and they're clear. Because I think that that's the hard thing. If you are the two people in the garage trying to build a company and you've got something and it's really unclear whether or not you're going to need FDA approval, that's really hard to those are hard circumstances to work under.
What you just said, Steve, sounds like the whatever the line is might be drawn less on the actual app than on the use to which the information is put.
It depends on you know, what's the app and what's the service. I mean, I think that's right. And it's less about the data collected, maybe even less about the analysis of the data, but more about any recommendations for action about that. And actually, that brings up another point. In the focus group research that was done with the chronology.md project, after patients had a chance to use that, they talked about being able to see connections among different aspects of their health. So, for example, Crohn's patients who were saying, you know, when they looked at activity level and sleep and noticed that, you know, more activity and more sleep had a real effect on their energy level, but actually their energy level being increased had a real effect on decreasing their pain level. You know, that's an important insight that you can get from an app, you can get from algorithms, and you can make changes in your behavior, you know, that can help you take advantage of that. I don't think anything in there is necessarily, you know, rises to the level of medical treatment, you know, or providing, you know, medical advice. But at the same time, it's important insight that you can get from the data.
I just want to be clear that I didn't mean to suggest that there should be no oversight, okay? I think oversight is good, but it's got to be reasonable mm-hmm. and timely, and it's got to make sense financially.
Fair points.
Okay. Yep.
Yes, we're at this microphone.
My name is Andina Nash, International Journal of Hygiene and Environmental Health. I hope this is far-fetched, but can you imagine a scenario where it is required or mandatory to provide ODL data in order to be eligible for a certain health care plan, and how could we prevent that?
Wow. Interesting question.
So I'll take the first crack at that. The technology infrastructure to make that possible is obviously there. You know, that could happen. That's where policy comes in, and that's why it's so important, I think, when you have technology and the applications of technology emerging, that you bring in policy so that you can have discussions about values and what sort of rules you want to put on it. Again, I think this is another example where it's what you do with the information that ought to be subject to laws and policy and play out in the proper law and policy arenas.
Anybody else? Okay. Yes, go right ahead.
I'm Dr. Caroline Poplin. I'm a primary care physician. In my last life, I was an attorney. I just wanted to comment on the doctor's observation that the doctors weren't overwhelmed by the information and that the whole thing went pretty well. 30 patients in a 7-physician setting is a small number over a short time, and you picked out one problem. Say, for instance, in the lupus patient who had 5 or 6 problems that could have been followed and monitored. If that were scaled up, even limited to sick patients as it should be, that's a lot of work. And a $20 per patient per month management fee is not going to cover that. If you want physicians to use it and do it and keep up with the information, which they must, as a lawyer, I know a common cause of malpractice lawsuits is something that was missed and then turns out, you know, goes along and turns into something much more serious. So you can't afford to overlook things. If you want people to do it, it would be a good idea until we get to the great ACO in the sky, pay doctors for looking at the information and pay them for telephone calls. There's already a code for it. It saves everybody money. It's convenience for the patient. It saves the doctor time and money. It saves the payer time. I don't understand why CMS can't pay for phone calls. There's no congressional law forbidding it. They could start the administrative thing going tomorrow.
My response, I guess, would be I don't disagree with anything you said. and I don't think anything I said disagrees is counter to what you're saying either. I said that either we had to find a way to pay for this or, you know, it would need to be bundled into those other ones. And you're quite right that if we had every patient with asthma and diabetes and you name it collecting this data, that would be impossible. But if we had found that for these 30, just a small number of 30, that the clinicians said, no, this is too much, that might be a death knell for this kind of work. But I think we have to be selective, and you're right, it's got to be reimbursed because it does, at the end of the day, it takes somebody's time.
And ACOs will not take it seriously if it's not reimbursed now. It will just be one more thing to do for the same amount you're getting paid today. Thanks.
Can I just ask, has anybody heard of an interest level from ACOs, either the private ones or the ones running through CMS, in adopting any of the use of ODLs or other kind of data that we're talking about, the patient-generated data? And I would welcome if people have the answer to that question or not on the panel, that would be fine, since we don't have CMS folks on the panel.
Yeah.
And since you were out of microphone range, I will condense that answer by saying yes, particularly in Minnesota. Thank you very much. Do you want to identify yourself?
Edna Boone.
Edna Boone. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Kos Makrodimitris. I'm an advisor on health information management and strategy for different organizations and small businesses. And I was a former FDA fellow, so I'm going to just give my 2 cents in the question asked before about the mobile apps, just very briefly. First of all, I'm going to agree with Devin. What she said is absolutely right. So FDA is not trying to regulate the whole mobile application platform there. They are trying to focus on specific high-risk applications that has to do with clinical decisions that affect the patient drastically. So always the FDA thinks risks and benefits, and they decide if this is something we need to regulate. So it's not just the application. It may be also the device, the mobile device, because mobile device is not just your smartphone. It can be a sensor. It can monitor data. It can be together with other devices. So that's the main concern. So the one aspect is that I want to mention, just to complement what Devin answered. And then the other aspect is something that some people, they don't know so well about the definitions of devices according to FDA and the government. So biomedical software, especially when it's connected to patient safety, is under the regulatory authority of FDA. They haven't invoked the authority in all these aspects because for certain reasons, and ONC also has done a lot of good work the last years taking action on that, but they can go ahead and regulate biomedical software in a lot of areas. But of course, for the sake of innovation, we don't want to make this not affordable. So that's my other point. So just to give a little clarification on that, and then my quick question is this to all of you. I think we've seen the Affordable Care Act ruling already passed, and we're looking now for the developments after that. And there are certain provisions there, especially in quality reporting, that has to do with needs implementation of information technology. And I'm going to mention what states has to do, what hospitals need to collect and report performances and measures. There are standards there that they need to implement and other things and other funds that need to be given, of course, in the innovators to make this work in the quality reporting. So in this part of information technology, what are your thoughts? What do you see as a timeline for the state and the federal and also for innovators as we now go to the implementation of the healthcare reform, how we can do this better or what do you see in the future?
That's such a devastatingly complex question that you've stumped the panel.
Well, and I would say, again, since we sort of have ways of influencing the healthcare industry and healthcare policy that are kind of nested within a bunch of different agencies within the federal government, if you're even just thinking of the federal government, and then you have all of the interesting initiatives that are happening in the private sector, it's not one clear timeline. It's kind of, you know, sort of multiple initiatives going on somewhat simultaneously, each one kind of piggybacking off of the other. I can say that at least from the Health IT Policy Committee's perspective, we're already starting to look at what the criteria would be for the third stage of the EHR incentive program, which would include, you know, a set of objectives for being a meaningful user, as well as what the technology has to include in order to be certified, and then all of that subject to eligibility for federal subsidy. And we're definitely exploring the capability to be able to incorporate patient-generated data from a potentially wide variety of sources, with the provider having the option to choose which one works best for his or her particular patient population, and starting with a relatively low threshold of patients, taking into account all of the provider issues that are discussed. So there's one sort of set of initiatives, again, being discussed. It's very early stage 3 discussions, but it's still
sort of hearing and looking at sort of where the potential is to really move the needle on quality and cost issues and trying to drive some incentives in that direction.
Yes.
Hi, Frances Correa, Family Practice News. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail about some of the incentive structures. You mentioned a couple, but incentive structures to really encourage physicians to integrate some of these technologies and down the line how that's really going to affect their meaningful use requirements.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we're really at the start of the incentives that are really sort of more kind of aggressively focusing on bringing the patient view into the process versus, you know, really the focus for stage one and much of what we've seen of proposed rules for stage two have been about equipping patients with the data that they might need, that they can then use themselves, which is, you know, a necessary first step. But where the bidirectional flows are concerned, that raises, you know, additional issues both from a policy and a technology standpoint, and that's why they're really getting a more meaningful look for stage three, which, you know, feels like it's way out there, but it's actually not. It's just around the corner, especially if we have an expectation that the technology vendors who are still busy implementing stages one and two will be able to get the product upgrades in time to be really ready for stage three. So first focus being, you know, at the A, of JOIS 3A's, the access piece of it, you know, do patients have access to electronic data that they can really use? We've seen the VA's Blue Button Initiative. We've seen CMS do a Blue Button Initiative. There's lots of discussion now about how to make that, you know, sort of ability for you to get a view and download of your health information and be able to sort of take that elsewhere. So others may want to talk about it. I think we're just, and on accountable care organizations in particular, you know, that's the financial incentives are driven toward outcomes. So to the extent that there are, you can actually realize good outcomes by taking care of patients better when they're still in their homes, you know, that's something that I think is going to be, it doesn't surprise me that there's at least one ACO that's exploring it because it's a very appealing way to leverage resources and get good, better outcomes.
Yeah, I think the way I would think about it is to remind everyone it's very early days on this kind of work. And the studies we're done are very small, you know, not statistically significant claims to make here. But what we're seeing is promise, but we're also seeing promise not all patients, not all the time, not all circumstances. So for me, the question is less about, you know, how do you provide incentives for people to do this, and more, do you create a policy environment where it makes sense to do, or where you're able to do this when it makes sense and when you can find value in it, and not be hampered by policy that says, you know, don't do this even if it's a good idea because we've structured your payments or we've structured the rules to prevent it. So it really, in some ways, that's our purpose of trying to share this work at this point, is to say, you know, this is coming along. There may be some real opportunities here, you want to make sure that the policy environment enables those opportunities to be realized, but not necessarily create incentives to say, you all need to be doing this now.
Anything else? Yes. Go ahead. Oh, wait, no, we're here. Yes.
Yeah. Deneen Grooms from the American Academy of Neurology. And my question is, I think she pretty much asked the same question I wanted to ask. I was just thinking from a provider perspective with respect to the smartphone apps like Breathe Easy that was mentioned. It wasn't clear to me when I was listening to the discussion exactly how this would be implemented or who would be the decision maker. Would it come from the physician who would identify the patient and say, I think you'd be great for this? Or would it be the patient who would see the app and say, or would have access to the app and say, I think this would be a great way for me to kind of manage my care? It was a little confusing to me. It's who is the entry point? Where does it begin? Is it the physician who identifies the patient and then they go from there? And the reason I ask that is because it was mentioned that perhaps in the emergency department, physicians there or clinicians there may identify patients who would be eligible, you know, to use the app. So if you could just provide some clarification on exactly what's the intent, who's supposed to use this? Is it the physician that identifies the patients, or is it the patient? I would appreciate that.
I think at the end of the day, there's going to have to be some negotiation between those two parties, and it's not a unilateral decision. But in a medical home world, it wouldn't necessarily just be the ER physician who was seeing that this patient was in the ER. I would know that as a primary care doc, that they've been in the ER. And to me, I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer to it, but I'm perhaps being a physician, I'm thinking more physician-centrically here and assuming that we would be identifying these people.
Okay. So it would not replace the physician?
No, I don't think so. I mean, okay. I think it's an integral part of what, it would just become another tool that we have.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Brennan. I'm the Executive Director of the Home Care Technology Association of America, which is an affiliate of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice. So I think I'll give credit maybe to Janet as far as health happens outside the clinic. Maybe is I think that one of the things I heard on the panel that came out today. One of the things that we're trying to do is align with a group of providers that provided incentives for electronic health records along with acute care, those providers, with non-acute care and post-acute care providers. And so we've identified as this a huge need to try and make sure that we have alignment across the spectrum of care. I've been working in that regards under the SNI framework. It's a community-led initiative to create a longitudinal care plan. And part of my question is an informational, just to make sure that you are looking at that model, the home health plan of care. Our use case was just developed through the SNI framework, and we'll go through HL7 balloting that we plan on using and hoping to use across a platform of care providers. In other words, physicians, it'd be a partnership with them, but other partners could use this as an electronic means of establishing goals, interventions, and also all those being measurable, backed up by clinical data that can be collected either remotely by remote patient monitors or on-site by clinicians. So I just wanted to, as part of my question ask, is more of overarching look. I know that we've had a very specific look today at specific programs and interventions, but what new models of care coordination are going to be needed in order to better engage patients in their care? And have you thought of how this is going to happen on sort of a holistic way? Thank you.
I can take a stab at that. The Bipartisan Policy Center released a report earlier this year looking at the attributes of high performance, reducing costs and improving quality in healthcare, and the patient activation engagement piece is huge and a common attribute across a number of organizations that we interviewed. I think, and this relates to there were two questions around payment. I think looking, as Steve mentioned, at specific actions and reimbursing them is very different than actually, and we're very encouraged to see a number of the delivery system and payment models that are being tested by CMMI, a number of states, a number of health plans across our country, and providers that are actually providing incentives for better care, coordinated care, accountable care. And this is just a piece. So clinicians, doctors, working with those who provide financial support for these models, working with patients that are heavily involved in governance in a number of these initiatives is the way forward. And we applaud your leadership around, home care, and this is really the wave of the future.
My question is about data aggregation. It seems like we're talking about a patient entering old metrics over a new medium, and the physician is the one who aggregates that data, instead of perhaps a different way of doing things, like perhaps a Target, which has more data points than my healthcare provider, I'm guessing, and who can also figure out when people are pregnant, without having to ask them. So what kinds of, are we heading that way? And at the same time, would such systems, which would necessitate, the computerization of healthcare, allow people to operate at the top of their license, as we say? And also, are there barriers to it where physicians will feel like, they're Watson technicians? Watson's the IBM computer, which is made to do this sort of thing.
So that brings a whole interesting area, and there are companies like Patients Like Me and Cure Together where people enter a lot of information about themselves, their treatments, their experiences, and then can sort of see in the aggregated crowd how they're doing relative to others, and insight can be done from that. There's some great stories of patients finding that they were only on 10 milligrams of something because their doctor said that's all anyone should really take, and then they find out that 90% of people with similar conditions are actually getting 100 milligrams, and so they can go back to their doctor and say what gives. So I think there's a ton of opportunity there. I think the again, sort of who's doing what with those insights is always a good question. So again, in the example of the person who was on an awfully low dose, they can go to their doctor and they can say, I'm not saying that I need 100 milligrams, but evidence would suggest that all other people are on it. So let's have a conversation about that. The other thing that I think that this does is it really does open up the question of what professional skills are needed to do what tasks associated with providing care in a coordinated, team-based fashion. And I think the example of Breathe Easy, where they had, in fact, nurses reviewing the data, the dashboards from the patients, and then triaging, escalating to physicians, was a good example of saying, let's put the right task with the right person with the right skills. And divvy up the work that way. I don't know, Steve or others, if you have thoughts on that.
Well, I was just going to add that if I'm remembering correctly, Steve, didn't every project end up with a model like that where there was in none of these projects did they decide that the physician was going to be the first viewer of the information?
Yeah, absolutely. There's always some element of team going on.
There you go. You get the last question.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon, Edna Boone. Taking it back to reimbursement and a nice lead-in with every model ended up with a different care team, maybe taking a piece of this before it got to that end care provider that might make a decision. But each one of those pieces of the puzzle comes with a salary, right, and a need for reimbursement. So a couple things that came up that the physician brought up earlier around telephone visits is the Chapter 10 of the broadband plan really spoke about e-visits. And this is now, we're going on 4 years sitting on that plan and components of that plan. So how do we, one, move policy forward that keeps up with the technology at hand? So we're looking at e-visits, for one. We're looking to update the very antiquated reimbursement for telemedicine, which is probably 5 years behind on the books, which means 10 to 15 years behind in terms of what the technology can do today. So, applaud the ACO model and what's happening with the Innovation Center, but how can we raise that discussion both at ONC and at CMS to look at moving those reimbursement structures forward? And then also, how can we look at other industries and what has happened in the microfinance world? So we talked a little bit earlier about co-pays, but if you look at, for instance, the music industry, one of the ways that Apple turned that on its head was you could buy a song for 99 cents. Well, everybody said, well, geez, I can sell an album for $20 or $15. Why would I want 99 cents? Because the way that they made it so easy for people to grab that music. And do we look or have we looked at other industries and the way microfinance is used and being used in other parts of the world, not in the U.S., and bring that to bear on healthcare? What if it meant that a provider just got very many, many small payments, maybe not out of the insurance industry, but directly from patients? I'd be willing to pay, right? But we don't have those financial structures in place at all in the U.S., or barely, right? So we have Square that's moved in, and that's the beginnings. But how can we look at, again, some of the other things that are happening in other industries that might help move us along?
I think rather than a question, Edna, you've just thrown out several really important challenges for all of us who are sort of looking to move, see the needle moved on healthcare, both for patients and providers. We didn't come to the table with any experts on reimbursement, but I think it's fascinating, and it just underscores how we need to be thinking about health information and healthcare and health differently than the way that we've historically thought of it, if we really hope to leverage technology better and bring patients more into the center of the conversation and make all of it
work far better than it does today. So, you know, rather than questions, I'll say that good points and good thoughts to follow up on.
Do you have time for another question?
I'm afraid we don't. We actually have, and I apologize to all of the folks who put questions on cards that we didn't get to, but we have run out of time. And I want to come back and thank our friends at the Bipartisan Policy Center, particularly Janet Marcia Broda, our colleagues at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, particularly Stephen Downs, you for sticking with an acronym-filled, mind-stretching discussion, at least for some of us. I want to take a second to note also and thank Jackie Fitton and Beza Henock, who have labored for the Alliance as interns this summer, and this will be Beza's final day. I don't know if Jackie is going to be around when we have our briefing on Friday, but when you join me in thanking the panel for a great discussion, you will all be also be thanking Beza and Jackie.